You guys are so awesome. This town is awesome. The people in it are awesome. We're so happy to be here.
Hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler, and that was Elephant Revival, live at the Carbondale Mountain Fair on July 29th, 2011. Elephant Revival are long-time KDNK favorites since their first couple gigs at Steve's Guitars way back when. Remember those? Well, that Mountain Fair performance only solidified their relationship with their rabid Carbondale audience. And tomorrow afternoon at 1 p.m., be sure to tune in for a live in-studio performance by Elephant Revival right here on KDNK. Who will stop by on their way from Crested Butte to their Wheeler Opera House gig tomorrow night and helping KDNK celebrate its membership drive. So stay tuned. Elephant Revival live on KDNK tomorrow at 1 o'clock. The local therapist Jim Connington is a proponent of choice theory and reality therapy. His mentor in that strain of psychology was William Glasser, MD, who passed away several years ago, but who became a good friend of Jim's. And Jim has written a new book called Thoughtful Answers to Timeless Questions that features the letters of Dr. Glasser to patients and colleagues. Well, joining Express Yourself now is Jim Coddington, a newly published author. He has written a book called Thoughtful Answers to Timeless Questions, Decades of Wisdom in Letters from the Author of Choice Theory, William Glasser, MD. And Jim will be reading from and signing his book at Explore Booksellers next Wednesday, and he joins the program now to talk about his book. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks for having me here, Luke.
As I recall, you've been on the program before, and we talked a little bit about choice theory and reality therapy.
Yes, we did.
What are those things?
Well, actually, what I would like to do, because this book, Decades of Wisdom, is a compilation of letters written to and replied to the writer by Dr. Glasser over decades. So I'll just read from the foreword that will give us a taste of what choice theory is.
Perfect.
While compiling the material for this book, I was reminded of many of the personal interactions I had with Dr. Glasser, some of which I would classify as truly inspirational. During one such interaction, I asked Dr. Glasser what his great teacher G.L. Harrington taught him. Instantly, Dr. Glasser replied, "Jim, I cannot tell you what he taught me. I can tell you what I learned from him." I had an epiphany when I heard these words. I realized that Dr. Glasser rejected the external perceptive of being taught, meaning that somebody else was doing something to him. As a choice theorist, he fully embraced the internal perspective of having learned based on information Dr. Harrington shared with him. I learned that Dr. Glasser was an expert at recognizing and utilizing the language of choice theory in increasingly more subtle and profound ways.
Interesting. I cannot tell you what he taught me. No. What was it? I cannot tell you what he taught me, but I can tell you what I learned.
Exactly. And the first time I heard that, I was silent, and it takes a lot for me to be silent.
Really?
Yeah. And because I really got to understand on a deeper level the depth of choice theory. Just as you said, when somebody's teaching us, it's them doing something to us. When we're learning something, it's our internal motivation that's being engaged.
It seems like this theory is very much a product of its time. Is that correct? Could this have happened in the time of Freud, for instance?
It's interesting you should mention that, because when Dr. Glasser went to, during his internship, he actually was a doctor of psychiatry. He had a bachelor's of chemical engineering, a master's degree in clinical psychology, and MD in psychiatry. So when he was working with Dr. Harrington, Dr. Glasser really didn't get caught up in the Freudian model. And when he told that to Dr. Harrington, Dr. Harrington came from behind the desk, shook his hand, and said, "Welcome to the club." It's a very, very small club back then, because reality therapy is very much based in the here and now. Uh-huh. What we can do from this point forward, as Dr. Glasser said, if you didn't have lunch yesterday, you can't eat that lunch today.
Well, you say here and now, and of course, I think of Ram Dass and Be Here Now.
Yes.
Are the two related?
I think on some spiritual level, because I did give a talk at a William Glasser National Conference in Las Vegas, and what I did, I compiled teachings from different spiritual masters, enlightened beings, and there were many similarities between what they said are saying what Dr. Glasser said. And he never considered himself an enlightened being, but he sure has a lot in common with a lot of the philosophy.
Well, based on that quote that you just gave, that tells a lot right there.
Oh, you want to even dig deeper?
Yes, please.
And as you know, many of us here are environmentalists, and here's one in the chapter explaining choice theory. If we continue to use the external control psychology, which tears people apart and destroys relationships, we'll make no progress in improving the way we get along with each other. That's the main task of the world. It's as important as the ozone layer and the greenhouse effect. What good would it be to have a healthy planet if we can't get along with each other? To me, that's the bottom line. I support that all that everyone is doing in terms of environmental health, but the environment that exists between two people, the destructive environment of external control, should be replaced with the constructive, helpful, supportive environment of choice theory.
Wow, that's impressive. That sounds to me like the reason we have an unhealthy planet is because we have unhealthy people on it in unhealthy relationships. Does that make sense?
That's the first time I've heard that, but yes. Huh. I think there's very much of a correlation.
Huh.
Because I think as we treat each other better, and even more importantly, as we treat ourselves better, automatically it will be, that will equate to how well we treat the environment we live in.
Huh.
Yes.
I gather that choice theory and reality therapy were rather a revolution in psychoanalysis. Is that a fair statement?
To say the least, I had the pleasure of not only having Dr. Glasser as a mentor, but as a very, very dear friend. He's one of the best friends I'll ever have. He passed away in August of 2013, and I still think about him a lot. And it's beautiful because his wife, of course, misses him, his widow, and she says whenever she reads his books, it's like hearing his voice. Because the way that he writes is it's as if he's speaking. It's just so easy to understand and implement. And that's the beauty of these letters. You don't have to really study choice theory to get it. I think in just reading some of these letters, you can actually change how you're interacting with others and improve your life. You don't need a PhD to practice choice theory. Huh. All you need is a willingness to improve relationships.
Huh. Well, let's hear some more of the letters.
Well, here's a quick blur, because Dr. Glasser, he did correspond with a number of inmates. And this is one of a one-liner that I really like of his, because, of course, he's gotten some grief, especially working with a prison population, which he doesn't have much experience with from inside the wall. So one of the inmates was giving him a hard time about that. And he says, "You're right. While I may not know what it is like to be in prison, what I do know is how to stay out of prison.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned prison, Jim, because I read the little blurbs on the back of the book briefly, and there's something from a person who set up a prison program and used choice theory and reality therapy as the foundation for his program, and reduced recidivism among parole females in 5 years from 67% to 2.9%.
I believe 57%, if I'm not mistaken.
It says
even higher, 67.
Right here. 67 to 2.9%.
Yes.
That's remarkable.
And that study was actually conducted by Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, and it was published in the Sage Journal. Those are very two reputable organizations. And what they have found in teaching choice theory to the population, that it was just dramatic, the kind of improvement. And I've actually, part of my training was going into the prison and listening stories from the inmates. And I can just imagine that being in prison is one of the more externally controlling environments. But what they have found is that the young ladies learning to implement choice theory, they were using it with the guards. They were attempting to build relationships, and they would just realize that even having a relationship with the guard was very important in their life and each other. And then they got to see the power of the choices they made in their life. And then they could see that, hey, I do have a choice. A premise of choice theory is we have five basic needs, one of the basic needs being freedom. And I think a lot of people who live in this area have a high need for freedom. And people who are in prison, they can see, hey, I have a high need for freedom. I don't have as much freedom as I would like. But that being said, they can get more freedom in a prison, because I do some work at Garfield County Jail. And if the inmates, as they show good behavior, then they have more and more privileges, more rec time, things like that. And this happens where, you know, people can start seeing, you know, I do have some power in this situation. I can gain a little bit more freedom back. And then once they get out of prison, they can realize the choices they made that got them into prison. They can think about, hey, I have a lot more freedom when I'm out here in the real world. And, you know, so it's tapping into that internal motivation once again.
I can't help but think of the prisoners inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., and how they might benefit from some of these precepts.
Yeah, what I like about that statement is, in a choice theory way, what would actually happen would that representatives would actually listen to what people are saying to them. And I'm not taking sides on what the issues are.
Right.
It's that people actually listen to each other's voices so they'll be heard. One of the seven caring habits is negotiating differences. And I think that that could have a dramatically improve the democracy in our country, because we've lost that taste of consensus. And it's still there. Sometimes we have to look harder to find the common ground. But it can be done, and I've seen it done. I lived in Austin, Texas for a while, and there were these stories about the environmentalists against the developers. Common story. And the story that I heard was the mayor at the time, Watson, when he was newly elected, he invited both sides of the issue to come over to his house and just sit down and talk. And guess what? They started compromising, because they realized neither of us can get everything we want, but we can both get more if we're willing to compromise with each other. It's something as sounds simple, but the hard part is getting there, is that the environmentalist wanted a certain parcel to hang on to. The developers thought it was prime commercial. Well, and the environmentalists said, well, how about if you take this plot, which isn't as important to us, and the developer says, you know what, we can make just as much money there. So they actually says, we'll do this land swap, in a sense. And this way, both parties were happy.
Yeah. Jim Coddington, let's remind people that you have a reading and book signing next week at Explore, Wednesday at 6:30. And we have time enough for another excerpt if you'd like to share one with us.
Oh, here's a, here we go. I'm just another short blurb that I like, and this is from Dating and Marriage. And we're talking about the need for freedom. Freedom is the hardest thing really for people to get if they want to be in a relationship, because you can't have all you want. You think anybody can relate to that?
Yeah, that's a universal theme, isn't it?
And the beauty is because when we can look at our basic needs and our partner's basic needs are survival, fun, and freedom being one, power, fun, and freedom. And sometimes somebody in the relationship may have a higher need for love and belonging, whereas their partner may have a higher need for freedom. So if they can actually discuss this with each other, and one of the partners who can say, hey, I do have a high need for freedom, but I see that you want me around the house more because that love and belonging, they could actually come to some kind of compromise and say, I'll be willing, I have a high need for freedom, but I'd be willing to spend, you know, this amount of time with you, this many weekends, but I want to have one weekend off to go off camping and fishing with my buddies. But somehow get to understand where we're both coming from and how that worked to both parties' advantage, because in any relationship, there's actually three entities. There's both parties and the relationship. When we can start looking at bringing the relationship into that as a third party, choices can be made based to improve the relationship as well as getting our personal needs met.
Huh. Makes perfect sense. Makes perfect sense.
It's actually very simple. They say The hard part is actually to implement it, because we're so caught up in an externally controlling world that we have to take a leap of faith and try this. But what I say is, Dr. Glasser said, if you use choice theory, it's not going to hurt. You've got nothing to lose. And I think that, you know, I'm hoping if anything, at least one thing some people can take from this is the ultimate question is basically about what I'm about to say or do going to bring us closer together or push us further apart. And just think about, do I really need to say this? If I do, is this the right time to say it? And what's a more loving way to say this?
Words of wisdom. Thoughtful answers. Timeless questions.
Timeless questions.
Thank you, Jim Coddington.
Thank you, Luke.
It's not going to hurt, and there's nothing to lose. Those are some good catchphrases for life, as well as the KDNK membership drive. If Express Yourself is a show that you enjoy and have come to depend on, won't you call us at 963-0139 and pledge your support to us? We would appreciate it, and we'll love you forever. All right, stay with us. Glassblower Robert Birch is up next on today's Express Yourself. And that is just a little snatch of the new Master Sounds, their tune Minx from their CD Masterology. The new Master Sounds plays Belly Up on Monday night, this coming Monday, March 6th. Well, the evidence for an artistic renaissance happening right now in Carbondale abounds. You can see it with the visual arts, you see it with theater, certainly music too. And I just discovered the same is true about glass art. Right now, over at the launch pad, there's an exhibition titled Incandescence, part of which features the work of 9 local glassblowers. I spoke with Robert Birch, one of those glassblowers, who also curated the glass portion of the show, yesterday, about the state of glass art in the Roaring Fork Valley. Joining Express Yourself now is Robert Birch, glass artist. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
And new KDNK DJ, too.
Exactly.
You like that?
DJ Berto.
So do you have a certain playlist for working with hot glass?
Metallica.
Oh, don't tell me. That's funny. Seriously, yeah.
Yeah, it depends on the mood of what you're making, but sure. when you're going huge and the whole team is working, yeah, it's good to have the upbeat stuff.
Well, I watched several videos on your website, robertbirchllc.com, and interesting, instructive for me. I don't know much about glass. You know, I saw you pull several blobs of molten glass out of the kiln, but what happened? How did it get to that point? Is it like a conglomeration of sand? What? Tell me about it. How does it work?
There are a number of American factories that produce glass that we use. And it more or less looks like 50-pound bags of ice cubes. And so it's on its second melt. So a different factory will formulate stuff, and it's mostly silica and a few different fluxes to lower the working temp. And more or less, they just put it into a giant furnace that spills glass out, and they chop it up into these little pillow-looking things, ice cubes, and they just ship it out. And then we throw it into a different furnace, and you pull it out on steel rods, more or less.
I saw a number of specialized tools. I'm sure there are plenty of those to cut it and shape it. And you have to do that while it's hot, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. The working temp is around 2400, 2350. And not many of the tools have changed since medieval times.
Seriously?
Yeah, except for the computers on the kilns and that type of thing. But I mean, we can dive into the history of it. More or less, you have a furnace which is a bucket of molten glass that hangs out all the time at around 2000. And then you have a reheating oven. It's about 2400. And that's where you can heat the glass up even hotter and manipulate it into whatever you need to make. And then you have an annealing oven, which is more or less a kiln. And that's at 1000. So when you're done working on the glass, you throw it into the kiln and you press go on the computer, and it cools it overnight for, you know, a standard cup thickness. And then that's called annealing, and that takes the stress out of the glass as it cools.
Huh. And I imagine you can add all sorts of things to the molten glass to get certain effects, powders, chemicals.
Exactly. And the way that glass color is made, people often ask this question, it's different metals mixed with glass and the first melt process. So, you know, magnesium will make black, cobalt obviously makes blue, and there's a different mixture of metals in the glass that change the color, and then you actually purchase the color because you don't want to be hanging out, you know, with powdered magnesium flying around or all those different things. So you just buy the color and mix it into the clear glass that you have.
I see. And then to finish it, I imagine there are all sorts of things you can add to the glass.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, diamond tools is kind of how you carve glass, you know, with engraving like Waterford crystal. You know, you can sandblast it. And the incandescent show is sort of an example of trying to push different mediums into glass and coating things. But you can actually, you know, coat glass with steel and make it rust. And the things that I think are the most interesting about that show, not necessarily from an aesthetic standpoint, but from a material studies standpoint, is a friend of mine named Jesse England up in Seattle had started pouring copper into vessels, and I thought that was a great idea. So I took that at a residency I was just at and used glass, like hollow vessels, to cast metals into. So I poured aluminum, bronze, copper, and mild steel, all at like a liquid temperature, into glass while it was about 1,000 degrees. And what's interesting about that is when you're casting bronze, you have a positive, you know, a wax mold, then a negative, a mold to pour the metal into, and then you get your bronze. But by using glass, you actually, on the fly, within 10 or 15 minutes, you can actually create a hollow form, like a mold, and then pour the metal into it. And it's highly incompatible, so you chip the glass away, but you've actually used this new medium, or this old medium, to use with metal in kind of a new way.
Oh, I see. That's interesting. Huh. How did the glass bug bite you? It's not the kind of art that most people immediately think of.
Yeah, that's a good question. I didn't actually think glass would be something I'd pursue. I thought photography was. That was really my first artistic passion. But I was on a senior project, and I worked for a photographer and a glassblower in the month that I had off. And by the end of it, I just realized that I didn't have as much fun photoshopping as I did working with all these weird tools. And there was some excitement to the heat and getting burned and trying to, you know. And that's more or less how I started to go into it. And then I just kept working in the factories over and over again, you know, and didn't really stop and just stayed with it.
That's how you learn.
Yeah, I tried to go to college for one semester, and it didn't really fit with me, and I couldn't quite understand why I was paying so much money for the approval of people that I didn't quite respect. And I had already been working professionally in a factory shop in Atlanta for a couple of years, but before I even went to college, so it didn't quite make sense to me, and I just didn't have the money to throw at it. So I moved to Seattle when I was 19 with a backpack and washed dishes at a bakery and started getting glass jobs on the side because I didn't actually think I had the chops to work on the level up there because it's the highest in the world. And, you know, just being on the teams, there's always, it's like a sailboat. There's no idle hands, so they'll always put you to work. And through that, you just sort of build your skill set up that way.
Huh. You worked with several or a couple of big names in the glass world, Martin Blank and Dale Ciulli.
Yeah, I was Martin's full-time guy for almost 5 years, and it started, I was just skateboarding by his glass shop, and he started yelling at me, like, I need some help, like, and so I just was torching, and the next day he called me and asked me to be his studio assistant, and I didn't really know who he was or, you know, frankly care. I just needed a job, and so I just, through him is where my, like, true experience comes from, because I wasn't just blowing glass on the team. I was shipping and packing, and through that learned the metalwork for the armatures and the gallery stuff and everything in between in the process that, you know, makes you a true professional as opposed to college, which I think prepares you more for a conceptual explanation of your glass or artwork in general. But I learned mostly through Martin. And then he is best buddies with Dale Ciulli, and every time we needed new colors for a series, Dale would call Martin. And we would kind of create our own team, and I was always in charge of running the colors for the Persians, and that was for a few years, and it was thankless, but it was also really interesting to watch the process, and kind of eerie to see your design on a poster at Seattle Center, you know, 6 months later, and just think like, whoa, I have nothing to do with this anymore. It was a weird thing to come to terms with, the thanklessness of that industry, but it was also cool because you can talk about it now and look back and learn from it.
Well, I guess you could say that about anything, really. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to, in order to refute somebody's technique, you have to learn it first before you say, that doesn't work for me. I like it to do it this way.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, you're getting paid to learn on the job, which is, I think, just the biggest part of just throwing yourself into any field or any craft is trying to just learn on the job. And if you show up on time and do a good job, they'll keep calling you back. You know, it doesn't really matter so much of the degree that you have.
Yeah. Huh. Now, you're not creating functional work, are you? It's sculptural.
Yeah, I've kind of departed from the functional stuff. I do some small production vases and things like that when people ask me to, but the less that I do that, the happier I am. There's so much that could be done with the medium in a sculptural realm, and I think combining different mediums with glass is the shortcoming in general, and so I'm just so focused on trying to combine glass and wood and metal and, you know, whatever else I can think of. Ceramics, we're doing a clay show. On April 1st, Friday, the Clay Center and a couple glass artists in the Valley are teaming up, and we're trying to develop a glass, it's called 96, compatible glaze, so you could put a glass handle onto a ceramic mug and it wouldn't break off.
Huh.
Something like that. So always just trying to push these ideas further and see what you come up with.
Interesting. Huh. And you must have a kiln and a workshop somewhere because, you know, it's... You need some room to do this.
Oh yeah, and that's the hard part in the valley.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
I have a space over at Saw, Allegheny, and his artist collective, and that's been really helpful because he's so great about just allowing you to explore ideas, whatever you want. He never says no. It's amazing, and so I've made a mobile glass kiln over there.
Which you will debut this afternoon on First Friday.
Absolutely. Crystal Glass Studio, Mary Matchell, and John, who used to be a DJ here.
Yes.
They're letting me blow glass out in their parking lot. And inside, it's a show of new pendant lights or new lighting. So it's a there's an art show inside and then outside. I'll be taking this strange mobile kiln out and trying to make glass in the parking lot and involve people. So we'll have some glass on the table and people can arrange it, and we'll try our best to make it into something functional.
So you can actually make any piece you would have made in a regular workshop in this mobile? No.
Absolutely not. No, this is using cane and Marini and what we call blank. So I actually make components at another glass shop, and then I can spend more time assembling them in this mobile glass shop. And truly, it's more of an educational unit than it is a professional one. I try to do most of my glass work at a shop in North Carolina that runs off methane gas from a landfill.
Oh, interesting.
And it's the only one in the U.S., I think, that's doing this truly. There's one that says they are, but they're not really. But Tim Muth does the Jackson County Green Energy Park, so I go down there for a couple months every fall to make all my work, just so you can alleviate the environmental guilt of this whole process by just using methane-powered glass shop to make your work. So I feel so much better about doing that. So
wow. Huh. That sounds like something worthy of pursuit here, if possible.
I think there's a survey going on right now of the feasibility of an anaerobic digester in the valley, anyone listening who knows about that, it would be a great idea. And a lot of times it's overlooked for the artistic applications, because you can run a glass blowing shop, a blacksmithing forge, and a ceramics kiln, all off the methane that would just be released into the air without, and you can capture and actually use it for art projects.
Huh. So. How about that? When you make a piece, Robert Birch, are you starting from a drawing? Do you draw your pieces first?
Hardly ever. No, I have an idea of how something will probably go in my head, and I'll work it out usually mentally. And when I'm in the shop, I'm at the point now where it tends to kind of go in the direction I'm thinking. But it's such a amorphous material. If it starts kind of going off the rails into another direction, it's less effort to fight it and just let it roll and kind of turn into whatever it's going to be.
So you have to be ready to improvise on the spot.
Absolutely. And what makes the work so much easier is when you have assistants, and it's just like in a band. You have your drummer, you have your, your bassist, and then you have, the lead singer. And if your team can work with you when something kind of goes off the rails and allow you to kind of just improvise in this way, and they don't question you and they don't ask you all these questions about why you're doing something, it makes your job so much easier. So Chihuly, one of Chihuly's employees, is my best friend, Taylor Ames, and he's my favorite guy to work with, because he just knows, like, if something just starts going this direction, to just roll with it and enjoy it instead of force it back to a certain way.
So let's talk a little about Incandescence at the Launchpad. It's a show that you curated, at least the glass part of the show, and it involves, 9 local glass artists?
I think less than that. We have Jacqueline Spiro, and she has a glass shop / casting shop kind of by the Waldorf School. And her son, Wyatt and Dylan, are also glass workers. So they're involved. Jose Chartier lives in Missouri Heights, and he's the real deal. When you take a step back and look at him in context of the entire glass industry, his work is amazing. It's so intricate. And then we have TJ Osula, and he was a glass worker in Australia, but he's from Glenwood, and now he's back in the Valley, and he's a great technician. And Lily Meadows, Allegheny's daughter, is actually a glassblower, so we had her involved. And Shannon Muse, she does fused work, and she shows out of Crystal Glacios as well. So I just was given the opportunity to curate the show, and I thought it would be selfish to only exhibit my work, because we have a huge amount of talent in the Valley. For such a small place, there's a lot of really good glass workers around here. Oh, and Mary Matchell and I did a collaboration, and Deborah Flug, who's a metal worker. But in this Valley, there's a lot of talent, so I just wanted to showcase that in a group setting, just to get the word out a little bit more that, there's a really cool sort of movement going on right now, and if anyone's curious, just to join.
You mean a movement of local glass artists?
Yeah, absolutely.
Huh.
I mean, I suppose the combined experience is like in the hundreds of years. Like Mary Matchell alone is huge wealth of knowledge, and Jacqueline and Dylan, I mean, they've got a great shop to work out of. So all the tools are there, and I think the people are starting to show up a little bit too. You know, and it's really, you know, 8 or 9 people, like you said, total. But, you know, in that group, there's not a lot that we couldn't put our heads together and figure out how to make for people, which is
great. How cool is that?
Yeah.
I had no idea that was happening in the Valley. What do you think accounts for that, that agglomeration of talent in this time and place?
That's a great question. I think it's more happenstance than anything. But the people that have shown up are so talented that it's kind of a great little mix of people. And we're trying to get the word out as we can. And Jacqueline and Dylan will host little parties, demonstrations. People can come and watch because it's a fascinating process. Not necessarily the final product. It can be a beautiful thing, but the process together is more like a dance than anything else. So I think it lends itself to a demonstration style. Huh. Work.
Let's talk about your piece in the show. It's part of your material studies series. Tell me about that.
There, you know, there's probably 25 or 30 pieces in there in the sort of material studies vein of exploration. And I try to address it like it truly is research, less than I'm making a painting or metal and glass can work together in a number of different ways, and I've been kind of exploring this for a while, and there's a lot of broken glass in this history, but I put glass onto a lot of pieces of metal or actually inflated the glass into pieces of metal, and because there's a shrinkage that happens while the glass cools, it can pull away from the steel and actually survive the cooling process without breaking. And so I've been experimenting a lot with just combining different metals in glass or wood and glass together. And that's where the material studies sort of title comes from. And I think it sort of speaks for itself when you go in there because there's no piece that's really repeated. And that's not my interest to repeat ideas. It's always just to go forward. And really it's just as simple as going through some buddy's metal scrap bin and pulling out things and thinking about how glass might work with these pieces of metal.
You know, listening to you describe your art and how you produce it, I'm struck by the fact that it's a combination of the technical materials aspect of it and the inspirational part of it. It's a fusing of the two, pardon the phrase. Is that a fair statement? Is that kind of the way you conceive of it? How does it work in your mind, in your artistic imagination?
Yes, that's totally accurate. I think, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years now. You know, I started when I was 16. And a lot of glass workers, I think, cripple the movement as an industry because a lot of people will find a certain idea and they figure out that it sells and then they make it in every color of the rainbow. And you can look back 20 years onto the big names, Ben Moore, Dante Marioni, and it's a very craft-based medium. And because they figure out the formula of what sells and they repeat it, that to me doesn't strike, it doesn't say a lot for the medium, and it's sort of an insult, and it does pigeonhole glass as craft. And so by trying to force glass into other mediums, it forces other mediums to interact with glass and take it away from the craft medium that it's associated with most strongly. And there's only a number of people that have ever taken it away from that, and one of them is Dale Chihuly, William Morris, you know, Howard Bentre goes to an architectural realm, and Martin Blank. So those are the real pioneers pushing the medium, and I'm just trying to just take a page out of their book and keep pushing it further than pretty vases and cups, which is what most people think glass art is.
Huh. And the ultimate goal is to be in a large, esteemed gallery? Is that what you're shooting for? How do you market your work?
I don't. I don't have any social media. I don't have any at all. And I have a website. I'm in a number of galleries and a number of them international museums too, but I don't actually think I have an audience. It's just, it's sort of a, I think, personal connections that sort of wind me up in these places, and maybe the work itself, I think, speaks for itself. Maybe one day, you know, people will talk about, you know, the name more, but I feel like being a career artist, then this talks to a bigger picture, but being a career artist is very vain and self-indulgent, and that's why I think why I don't even talk to many people about it, frankly. You know, it's sort of a private affair for me.
Interesting. You know? So kind of a purist approach to what you're doing.
Right. There's no market or, you know, there's no capitalistic endeavors to this. You know, I'm an artist and that's just, I'm never going to make any money. That's fine. You know, but it takes you great places and you just, you know, you can travel the country just like a band, like doing a demonstration at a college, talking about your ideas and how helping other people with their path. And then they give you gas money. You can go to the next college. So, I mean, there are ways to travel on it, but I don't have any name recognition. I don't really think. Maybe I do. I don't know.
Well, you know, you say the work speaks for itself, and at some point, somebody's going to hear that voice and see it, and that's what you're aiming for, it sounds like. And you know, I have to admire your purist approach to that, but I'm willing to bet that because you're so committed to how you do what you do, eventually that payoff comes.
Yeah, one would hope. I work for James Searles part time, and that's, you know, I make most of my income just from welding, frankly. And glass is like you said, a Puritan. You know, it's a really honest approach, and you know, I'm genuinely passionate about it. And that's with the mobile glass shop, just trying to help other people. And the art bus that's going to be driving around for CCAH, the glass shop will go with it so I can show kids in parking lots how glass is made. And that's sort of where my focus is. And it's a lot easier to not get on your high horse and tell other people how they should live or their career should go. It's much more humble just to do it yourself. And you avoid that offensive paternalism or altruism being enforced on anyone else. So I think eventually it'll just speak for itself, but I don't need to tell anyone else how to do anything.
Love that approach. Robert Birch, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Incandescence remains at the R2 Gallery until March 17th, and it also features the encaustic paintings of Aaron Rigney. You can get more information at carbondalearts.com. Stay tuned. Suzanne Paris up next on today's Express Yourself. Lettuce playing tonight over at the Belly Up. That show sold out, so you snoozed and you lost. All right, Suzanne Paris joins Express Yourself now. Suzanne is a longtime local musician who has probably graced just about every stage in the Roaring Fork Valley several times and played with musicians as varied as Dave Mason, The Temptations, Stephen Stills, Richie Havens, and local musicians too numerous to mention. Suzanne takes the stage this Sunday at Justice Snow's in the second of its Americana series shows, and that show will feature John Michel and Michael Jude playing with Suzanne beginning at 9 p.m. Welcome to Express Yourself, Suzanne Paris.
Thank you so much, Luke.
It took too long to get you on.
That's so dumb. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah? Yeah. Well, how's it going?
It's going great.
I see on your Facebook page you have a new single coming.
I do.
Tell me about it.
Well, I just went in the studio last night and put some vocals on it. It's called Silver City Blues, and it's got John Michel and Michael Jude on as the rhythm section.
Which is about as good a rhythm section as you can get.
It's slamming.
Nice.
I just gotta say, I had so much fun last night working on it, and it's coming along really well. I'm really pleased.
I think I watched a YouTube video of you playing that song. You were frolicking in a beautiful dress on a green lawn on a swing.
Yes.
Yeah, same song?
Yep, that's the same song. My little puppy was baby then. My little St. Bernard.
I saw that St. Bernard. And I saw that St. Bernard in the St. Regis at a gig that you were playing there with Vid Weatherwax.
Yes.
They let you bring a dog into the St. Regis?
They do. They love her.
Huh.
You know, she doesn't get to come in all the way, but a little bit. Just okay. The first part of the lobby.
Well, St. Bernards are a little bit slobbery, aren't they?
She's not for some really? Reason. Uh-uh.
Huh. Huh. You trained her.
Yeah, she just came that way. You know, she's Lady Penelope Panda.
That's her name?
Lady Penelope. Lady Penelope Panda, the Marilyn Monroe of St. Bernard's.
Oh, really? So her skirt blows up around her neck?
Her skirt blows up. She has a beauty mark. She wears eyeliner. Literally.
How long have you had her?
I've had her like 4 years now.
Oh, nice. How about that?
Yeah, I love it.
So you're recording a new album at Glenn Frey's old studio?
Yes.
Where is that studio? I have not heard of that one.
Well, it's at his former home, located in Old Snowmass. It also used to be Jimmy Buffett's house back in the day.
So ghosts. There's ghosts there.
Well, there's a great energy, I got to say. I mean,
really?
I definitely felt like, yes, you know, record, Suzanne, you know. Energy there. It's, you know, it's right on a beautiful river and nestled amongst some very tall trees, and it's got an enchanted energy.
Nice. So you have
the new owner. How lovely of her to want to keep that studio alive.
How about that?
So my friend Ralph Pitts is now the engineer, and it's called Mad Dog Studios, and it's available, you know, commercially.
Oh, it's
a world-class studio. It's beautiful.
Huh. How about that? So you're recording...
I've just started one song there, and actually this cut is going to also be on a compilation record that we're doing at the studio.
Oh.
And then I get to use it also on my new album that's called Summer Fire, coming out in the summer.
Well, let's hear it. It's called Silver City Blues.
Silver City Blues.
I'd love to hear it right now.
Okay, I'd love to play it.
If you just joined us, Suzanne Paris is joining the program live in the studio here at KD&K.
All right. I woke up in the morning, reaching for you like I've always done before. I started at the table, but I woke up on the floor. Ever since you bought those dancing shoes, I've been stuck here with these Silver City Blues. I've been waiting for someone to take my breath away. I've been waiting for someone to take my breath away. Flying higher than the eagle on the white line in my Cherry Cherokee. Got one hand on my pistol and the other down between my baby's knee. They say the fool is always last to know, but I'm stuck here with these blues, as you know. I've been waiting for someone to take my breath away. waiting for someone to take my breath away. I got some money in my pocket, gonna take it for an aeroplane. But I woke up in the morning reaching for you once again. They say the fool is always last to know, but I'm stuck here with these blues, as you know. Oh, oh. I've been waiting for someone to take my breath away. Take my breath away. I've been waiting for someone to take my breath away. I've been waiting someone to take my breath away.
Suzanne Paris live in the studios here at KDNK. You're a good blues singer.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and you know, I would think that you fit in very well with Michael and John.
It's fun.
You know, their band, Brothers Keeper, very much a blues band. So they're used to backing up some blues, huh?
That's true, actually.
How did you get together with those guys?
You know, I knew Michael Jude from a long time ago when I lived here in the early 80s, when he was in Little Blue and Steve Postel. But I never got to play with Michael. And when I came back to town, I just looked him up and said, oh my gosh, I really want to, you know, connect and play. And he was very welcoming and invited me to do some shows. And then, you know, he had John Michelle playing with him, and John and I really connect in a natural way too. And so we end up doing a lot of shows together as a trio and as duos. You know, sometimes it's Michael and I play, sometimes John and I play, and you know, John and Michael always have their thing going too. So it's been a real gift to reconnect.
Suzanne Paris playing Sunday night at Justice Knows. That starts at 9 o'clock, doesn't it?
It is.
With John and Michael. Well, before we go, I'd love to hear one more tune from you, Suzanne. We might have to fade out for the news, but sure. I'd love to hear another tune.
Sure. I'd love to play one for you. This one is written by David James Holster. He was in the band Starwood with Bobby Mason, and it's called World of Hunger. Also coming out, a new version of it goes like this. Come on, baby, go with me. I'll take you to the Pleiades, diamond-studded promised land. You could be my rocket man. Here on Earth, there's something wrong. The Sacred Heart has turned to stone. Lonesome people everywhere, looking for what isn't there. I don't wanna be in a world of hunger. Spill my tears, fill the sea in vain. I don't wanna be another number in a losing game. Since the day that Jesus rolled that stone, the beast and man's been free to roam. 2,000 years that monkey man turned Ellie Eden in the sand. Before I lose my sanity, all faith in humanity. Grab the cat, close the door. Love don't live here anymore.
Suzanne Paris playing live here at Kitty and Kay and playing Sunday night up at Justice Knows. Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stay tuned for the news coming right up. This is Kitty and Kay.